Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, in for Mike Collins. 70 years ago in Los Angeles, police officers became part of public education. In recent decades, propelled by mass shootings such as Columbine and Sandy Hook, federal, state, and local governments have kept ramping up law enforcement in schools. Those heightened security forces brought problems of their own, including here in the Carolinas. Recent analysis of federal data by the Center for Public Integrity confirmed what critics have said for years. Black students and those with disabilities, as well as other minority groups, suffer disproportionately when it comes to law enforcement referrals and other disciplinary measures. Here today to help sort through the challenges and possible changes to school security and discipline are Peggy Nicholson, who is supervising attorney for Duke Children's Law Clinic. Good morning to you.
Morning.
And from the Center for Public Integrity, reporter Corey Mitchell, who played a leading role in the series of stories that we will be discussing this morning. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
But Corey, let me begin with you. The stories that the Center for Public Integrity has published in the last week or so are based on federal data from the 2017-18 academic year. And as I mentioned, your reporting shows disproportionate levels of referrals, that is, students being, sent to the court system or police officers, school officers, as well as discipline against minority students. What is all students, but the disproportionate level of discipline against minority students, I should say, what is the scope of this problem based on what you found?
It's a nationwide issue. We found that in 31 states, including North and South Carolina and Washington, D.C., Black students were referred to law enforcement at more than twice the rate of white students. And that pretty much holds true in as many states for students with disabilities as well. So it is a problem, and it is one that's persisted for decades now.
And I let me back up one step. Is it safe to assume that this problem is more severe for the groups you just mentioned, but is problematic for all students, generally speaking?
It is problematic for all students. I mean, when we see these disparities, especially for Black students and students with disabilities, it's exacerbated. Even in states with relatively small Black student populations, we see these higher rates of law enforcement referral, which, you know, means they have contact with the law enforcement officer. And in a quarter, these referrals lead to arrest. So nationally, you're talking that school year, roughly 230,000 students referred to law enforcement. So somewhere in the neighborhood of 55 to 60,000 of these students were arrested in K-12 schools, not college campuses, but K-12 schools.
Peggy, one of the things that may surprise parents and students is how little federal oversight there is for students when it comes to their rights, including whether they answer questions from school officers, why they may be answering questions from school officers. Why has this gone neglected, and what is the likelihood of meaningful change?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's right. When a police officer is in a school operating as a law enforcement officer, they have a lot of discretion to question, to work with school officials, to identify things that, you know, might be perceived as a disciplinary incident, but could also be perceived as a criminal legal issue. And so given the broad range of discretion they use and the lack of oversight, it leads to instances of abuse. There's also a lot of lack of accountability at the state level. Like this data that Corey's drawn on in his reporting at the federal level, we don't have a lot more information in North Carolina other than to know that we have these high rates of referral, this racial disproportionality in the referrals. And so there's really a lack of oversight and accountability at almost every level of government. And that goes even to the local level of boards of education, inviting school resource officers in without really knowing the true impact that they're having on students.
Corey, you mentioned North and South Carolina. You know, it's a problem here. It's a problem everywhere. Generally speaking, how do the Carolinas compare with the rest of the country?
They aren't, when you talk statewide, they aren't among the worst offenders. These disparities still exist. There are some seminal cases that have occurred in the Carolinas that have really sparked the national conversation on the role of school policing. So it, in that way, it's played an outside role. But overall, the schools aren't the worst offenders, but these disparities still exist.
If you're listening this morning and you have a question, contact us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or on Twitter at Charlotte Talks. Even before the death of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police last year, a fair amount of pushback existed over putting and keeping police officers in schools. Some larger districts, as your reporting shows, Corey, have ended or cut back on funding for school officers. What do we know about the impact of those changes?
Well, I mean, they're relatively small in scope. Many of them have occurred in cities with Democratic leadership or college towns. But most of the rest of the country, there have been a lot of discussions, but not a lot of action. In those places where we've seen a reduction in school police or school resource officers, they're trying to find new ways to keep students safe, but to also divert resources to counseling and social workers and things that can help students in crisis, whereas before they may have just called in an outside law enforcement agency or their own officers to say, you know, this is a problem, find a way to handle it. This is disrupting my class, or, you know, this is causing a commotion in the hallway. And as we know, that may not always be the best response for a 7-year-old or a 17-year-old.
Peggy, I'm wondering if you have thoughts in terms of potentially better ways to handle some of these issues rather than having officers in schools or referring so many students to officers as a, you know, sort of first answer.
Right. Absolutely. The goal is safety, right? That's why we've, purported to put school resource officers in schools. And none of the research bears out that school police actually make schools a safer place. But we fortunately do have a lot of good evidence and research that shows investing in mental health resources, investing in more school support staff, such as school psychologists, school counselors, school social workers. It is a huge benefit to the overall school climate and increasing school safety and reducing disciplinary incidents. So I think the goal is, if we're going to invest money in something, let's do it in something that the research shows works. And that's the argument that a lot of folks have been putting forward. As I say, you know, we have no evidence that school police officers actually work to achieve the goal of safety, put aside the fact that the harm they might be causing. And let's instead invest that money in things that are evidence-based and have proven to work to support students and increase the entire overall school safety in the environment.
It seems to me that one of the most difficult aspects of following that prescription that you just outlined, Peggy, is school shootings. Obviously, I mentioned at the top of the show, here in Charlotte, we had a fatal shooting at Butler High School in 2018. CMS, the local school system, is typically at or near the top in terms of the number of guns seized on campuses. It's really difficult when you hear that to convince a parent and perhaps students and faculty that not having an officer is a better way to go.
Right. And I that's a very valid fear of these external threats. And the safety of our children is a value we all hold. I guess the flip side is, again, looking beyond kind of the anecdote and the fear to how do we want to inform public policy? And I think if you look at the research, that school resource officer programs have not been able to stop those instances, and they are still continuing to occur. So we have to look at other interventions as well that go to the root of some of these problems. And again, that goes back to early intervention in early grades with mental health resources, family support, making sure teachers have the tools they need in the classroom to handle disciplinary incidents without feeling like they have to rely on bringing in law enforcement. So I think that, again, that's a very valid fear, but we need to base it on what the data is actually showing and the research is showing in terms of school safety, rather than that gut impulse of how scary that feels.
And so, I mean, pardon the pun, it's an educational process. Yeah.
And I think the same can be said of suspension, right? For so long, educators felt like their only tool for disruptive students was suspension. And we have, over the years, more and more educators and school officials who are finding that suspension doesn't work, and it's not actually improving the school climate. So they're turning to other things that now we know are effective, and schools and districts are investing resources in those instead.
We're going to suspend our conversation for just a moment. Stay with us. More coming up on the criminalization of school children. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. We're continuing our discussion on school discipline and security and the criminalization of school children. With me today is Corey Mitchell. He is the lead reporter on a new series of articles by the Center for Public Integrity about disparities in school discipline among Black and disabled students, and Peggy Nicholson. She is supervising attorney at Duke's Children's Law Clinic. As we were in the break, Corey, one of the things you mentioned to me is the disparity, I keep using that word, in terms of how we look at this issue. We tend to go to the extremes, but there's a lot of nuance in there. Give us some examples of what that nuance entails.
Yeah, we often think of school police officers or school resource officers in sort of two veins. They're there to stop a school shooting or some other serious threat on campus. Or maybe we see some of the viral images of abuse of a deputy slamming a child on the desk or dragging them down a hallway. But a lot of what happens in these cases is, you know, sort of in the middle. It may be a teenager in class being unruly and yelling at a teacher and ending up facing, that student ends up facing a charge of disorderly conduct and ends up in the juvenile justice system. Or it may be a child with disability, either a mental or physical disability, who strikes out at a teacher in anger, and that child also ends up in the juvenile justice system. So there are things along a continuum that can lead to law enforcement referrals, arrest, juvenile justice system involvement. It's just not the extremes that we typically think of.
Why is there, based on the reporting and the data that you're citing, why do you think there is so much difficulty and mismanagement with disabled students in particular?
I think in part because, working with students with disabilities, can be difficult, even for educators who are trained to do so. But the moment that you call in a law enforcement officer, someone who doesn't have those same set of tools in their toolbox, things can quickly go awry. Officers only have, a few tools, and one of those is arrest. You follow orders, or, you face a threat of arrest. Some of these children may not be able to really comprehend what's at stake, and it only really increases the tension there. And I think that, educators would do well to sort of understand that before you call for law enforcement when things get out of hand. A counselor, a social worker may be a more appropriate response to deal with the crisis that is happening in the classroom, but also that's happening internally with the student. Introducing someone who's new to the classroom, who doesn't understand their education plan, often leads to, very bad unintended consequences.
Peggy, I see you nodding. Do you encounter that a lot in your work?
Absolutely. There are too many cases to name, but Corey's comments are making me think of one of my first cases I had as a lawyer in North Carolina in a rural district, where it was an 8-year-old student who had very severe ADHD that his parents, who were Spanish speaking, had tried to let the school know about, but the school had not done anything to address that. And so he was acting out at school and having a difficult time, again, only 8 years old in second grade, I think. And he got referred to juvenile court for disorderly conduct at school. And when we got involved, of course, we were able to get some special education services in place to address the ADHD, to pull the team together. We were able to get the charges dismissed, but not before an eight-year-old had to go out of school multiple days to go to court with his parents, not understanding the process at all, sitting in front of a judge. Again, a child with ADHD. And then once we got him some of those tools and supports for that rural district, you know, other students were able to benefit from that as well. They were able to kind of spot the signs earlier on and have the tools and training they needed to catch those cases earlier rather than relying on law enforcement to handle it.
Corey, before we go much farther, for people who want to read this series of stories, it's just at the Center for Public Integrity website, which would you give us that address so I don't bungle it?
It's publicintegrity.org.
And it really is a very well done series of stories and explains in layman's terms, which is important for me. So you can really get a sense of the scope of this problem and some of the challenges. I want to throw out a question from one of our listeners. Cheryl emails. She asks, have any school systems tried restorative justice to deal with issues that might have gone to the police?
Yeah. Corey, maybe you can speak on the national level. There are several in North Carolina that have started to turn that way, including in Charlotte. You know, the Charlotte Mecklenburg school system has been able to reduce their school-based referrals pretty significantly, especially compared to the state average. And some of that has been using restorative justice practices to handle things in the school building rather than referring to an outside law enforcement agency.
Yeah, and nationally, we have seen places where folks have turned this and significantly reduced the number of law enforcement referrals and arrests. But, you know, you have to be very intentional about this. And you often have to involve those school resource officers in this process if you're going to keep them. You can't totally exclude them. You may have to have conversations about a multi-step process before an arrest can be initiated. You may have to talk about walking them through conflict resolution training to help them understand how to help students resolve conflicts and how to help them also understand, you know, how I interact with a 6-year-old or a 16-year-old is going to be different than a 26-year-old or a 36-year-old. And to help them understand how children think and how their minds work, especially the adolescent mind. Teenagers can be frustrating. And to give them
sorry, I'm the father of two teenagers, so that just struck me. Go ahead.
and you have to sort of, you know, frame your thinking. If you're going to be in a school and interacting with these young people, you sort of have to frame your thinking around that they are little adults, but they're not adults yet. And you have to sort of you know, prepare for that type of work. It can be frustrating, but we also talked to some school resource officers who said the work can be very fulfilling.
I'll also add that the programs sometimes also don't employ a racial equity lens and can result in only certain students benefiting from those programs. So, for example, in Charlotte Mecklenburg schools, they've brought down significantly their school-based complaints. Still, 80% of those school-based complaints are against Black students. Even though Black students make up only about a third of Charlotte Mecklenburg School's student population. So if you are not thinking about how race plays a factor in these referrals in the program, you can kind of miss a key element here of the potential racial impacts of school referrals.
That's the voice. Go ahead, Corey.
I was saying that's something that we see across many of the nation's largest school districts that do have these programs. You are bringing down the number of arrests and referrals, but these racial disparities continue to exist. These disparities with referrals for students with disabilities continue to exist. So even if you are finding some success, you do have to dig a little bit deeper to get at the really big disparities that exist.
That's the voice of Corey Mitchell. He's a reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. Also with us is Peggy Nicholson. She is supervising attorney at Duke Children's Law Clinic. If you'd like to participate in the conversation, send us a note at charlottetalks@wfae.org or on Twitter @charlottetalks. I want to ask you both to offer some perspective on another set of statistics, or analyzed by the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, which is in Durham, where you are, Peggy. They looked at North Carolina's public schools for the 2019-20 academic year, and they found that Black students make up 25% of all students, but 55% of all suspensions, I should say. White students make up 46% of all students, but account for 26% of suspensions. It seems like when you hear those numbers, they're right in line with everything that Corey and the Center for Public Integrity are reporting. In other words, this is across the board a serious problem.
Yeah, when you look at any discipline data, those sort of racial imbalance in the numbers exist. And I think part of the problem sort of lies in some research that has been done on this around school resource officers specifically. When they work in schools with majority Black and Brown students, they tend to think of those students as threats that they need to protect or keep in line. When you talk about majority white schools or school districts, the resource officers often think of themselves as sort of the protectors of the students against outside threats. And that carries over into the classroom as well when you start talking about racial bias and how educators view different students. A student who may be, suspended for a minor infraction may very well be a Black student because of sort of the bias and fear associated with that student and their behavior. But a non-Black student may not face as severe a penalty. Children are children. They're going to do childlike things. It just depends on whether or not you're going to, criminalize them or not. And I would put that, suspension and expulsion data I would include those as factors that lead to sort of that school to prison pipeline that we hear about.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you about that. Peggy, two things. The first is, do those statistics for North Carolina in particular, do those track with what you see and hear anecdotally and otherwise? And also that pipeline that Corey just mentioned, if you could provide some insight as to why this is so damaging, how that affects that pipeline down the road.
Yeah, it certainly tracks with our experience in the clinic representing students and families across North Carolina in suspension hearings. We certainly see a greater number of Black students experiencing multiple or punitive suspensions, and that backs up the data. And I'll say that, that school to prison pipeline that Corey mentioned operates in so many direct and indirect ways. We often think about just that police officer in a school arresting and sending a kid to court, but there are so many kind of upstream things that happen that send kids and schools down that path. And suspensions are one of them, but there's even more, in-school suspension, detention, getting sent to the principal's office, not giving a child like the appropriate academic support, so they completely disengage from school and are more likely to display those behaviors that might get them at risk of a disciplinary exclusion. And then you go downstream and you see once that cycle starts to happen, that child is more likely to experience suspension again. They're more likely to end up in kind of long-term court involvement, less likely to graduate, more likely to have psychological and emotional effects of that, just the stigma of being pushed out of this school community. And all of that, at the same time, suspension is not working to increase school climate. It's not working to raise everybody else's academics. The research doesn't show that if you that theory of you get rid of the bad apple, all the good apples can, do what they're supposed to do. That's been disproven with research and data that it actually achieves that. So I think it's important to think about all the ways that the student gets pushed into this pipeline and really tackle each piece of that.
So, I mean, we're back to the definition of insanity, right? We're doing the same things, expecting different results. And I wonder, Corey, from your reporting, how much closing of ranks is there among administrators and school officers? Is there much of a debate about things needing to change?
I mean, there is a debate, but I mean, these school administrators, in the cases that we investigated, they often defer to law enforcement. And you will find people who will say that there are very few school officials who will say, okay, you're going a bit too far here. You know, this is an appropriate behavior with a child. You shouldn't approach a child in this way. Let's find another way to help this child. Let's not hurt them. So there are these discussions, but unless, you know, you sit down and it's like a multi-step process to explore what's going on, there isn't much change. There's been lots of talk, but not as much change as perhaps there needs to be.
That is Corey Mitchell with the Center for Public Integrity. Also with us is Peggy Nicholson. She is the supervising attorney at Duke's Children's Law Clinic. And we are talking about the criminalization of school children based in part on a series of articles that has just been published by the Center for Public Integrity. When we come back, we'll talk about some of the possible solutions as we dig into this issue further. I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and you are listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and we are discussing the issue of criminalization of school children and the disparities in referrals and discipline in our schools in the Carolinas and across the country. With me today is Corey Mitchell. He is the lead reporter on a new series of articles about the topic by the Center for Public Integrity, if I can spit it out. Also with us is Peggy Nicholson. She is supervising attorney at Duke's Children's Law Clinic. Peggy, what kinds of things are we seeing here in North Carolina in terms of maybe some alternatives to the way we've been doing things when it comes to discipline in schools?
There's been a great kind of statewide effort that acknowledges that we want to keep minor misbehavior dealt with in schools by teachers and parents and out of our juvenile and criminal legal systems. And kind of in recognition of that, there's been a push to have all the players come together in counties and kind of locally talk about, you know, what is going on in that county that causes young children to be referred to court for minor misbehavior, and to create memorandums of understanding and agreements that kind of spell out, here are the things we expect school resource officers to refer out of schools, and here are the things that we expect them not to get involved in. And so really kind of setting clear guidelines for school resource officers to follow, as well as additional training for school resource officers and additional data collection and kind of oversight of the program. And usually at the table during those, the creation of those memorandum of understanding, that's district court judges who hear the juvenile court cases and kind of know what's coming their way. It's school board members, superintendents, principals, school resource officers, law enforcement, ideally also community support services. What are the things we can do instead of referring? Like, what community services can we tap into if we have a child who has a need that the school can't meet? And so there have been some really successful conversations resulting in memorandum of understanding in many counties. It was actually a state law that pushed every county to do this work, led by their chief district court judge. And we're kind of waiting to see what the full impact of that will be. Will we actually see a huge decrease in school-based complaints coming from those memorandum of understandings that are happening across the state?
So it sounds like that is something you view positively, that there is some hope for improvement.
I think we have to watch and see. I think some of the arguments against it are that it does kind of further entrench school resource officers into schools, right? It kind of locks in their position while there are a lot of people who don't think they should be there in the first place. And so one of the things that if a district, if a county is undertaking that effort, having directly impacted community members, students and parents who have actually like experienced school referral at the table and giving feedback on what their experience have been is critically important. And then also that data collection piece, because right now we just don't have a lot of good local data about what's happening with police student interactions. And so really understanding the full impact and being able to see what's working and what's not working should inform our choices around whether we have police in schools.
Corey, I think there was an example you used in the series of stories that y'all have published, maybe in Clayton County, Georgia, of, I think it was maybe a juvenile court judge and some law enforcement officials getting together and saying, hey, look, we don't need to be involved, just as Peggy's saying, we don't need to be involved in kind of your routine classroom disturbances or acting out, those kinds of things. What kind of success did they have? And is it your sense that maybe others might try to emulate that model?
Definitely. In Georgia, you have a juvenile court judge who has made this a priority for him and others for more than a decade. He's testified before Congress. And he's working in concert with the school security chief in this district. And they're sending students to conflict resolution programs, workshops, instead of court. And they're trying to make a concerted effort. And they're also sort of working on those memorandums of understanding, not only to police what they do, but also to police what teachers are doing. You know, it outlines, you know, if kids are arguing in class, you don't need to call a police officer. You need to have them work it out. You need to work it out. You know, when tempers are flaring, you call in police officer. Sometimes bad things are going to happen. But you have to have people who are involved in the system and see what comes their way, understand that, and work to stop, you know, those types of referrals. Because it doesn't help anyone. It doesn't help the school. It doesn't help the child. It doesn't help the law enforcement agency or their image. You know, they aren't, you know, racking up arrests or referrals for children isn't going to, you know, win any commendations for anyone. But you really have to be intentional, and it has to be a lot of folks involved and lots of conversations. And as Peggy mentioned, you definitely want to get the parents and students involved as well. Folks who have been affected by this. It's easy to have conversations if you have children or parents who haven't been on the wrong side of law enforcement. They don't really understand the repercussions of all of this. So getting people at the table, having these discussions, being thoughtful about it and saying, you know, admitting that, you know, we have a problem. Let's find some solutions. That's the best way to go.
I wonder, you know, with this issue, particularly both of you have talked about this problem of routine behavior issues being referred to the school officer. How much of a factor do you think it might be that, as Corey mentioned earlier, we tend to go to the extremes? We think immediately of school shootings, you know, the worst case violence in the minds of a teacher. You know, if you're up there teaching every day and you're worried about this because this is your environment, these stories get a lot of attention. It's absolutely the worst case scenario in all ways. Do teachers begin to think, you know, this could turn into something far worse than just someone refusing to sit down or answer the question? And so they kind of go full tilt and go right to the officer.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. I was going to say there's one kind of promising effort in Wake County, because that is a concern. Teachers are like, we don't have the resources. We have huge classrooms. We have a lot of material we have to cover. It is really hard for us to practice good classroom management under the conditions we're expected to work in. And there's one promising effort that was first employed in Denver Public Schools and is now being pushed in Wake County to replace the school resource officers in several middle schools with peace builders, who are not law enforcement officers, not armed, can't arrest, but are trained in how to handle those types of issues, de-escalate conflict, use restorative justice practices to get the child back into the classroom as quickly as possible in a successful way, so that the teacher can do their job of teaching the class, but there's a designated person they can call who is trained in how to handle that in a way that causes the least harm to that child and the school environment. So there are some models that are trying to bridge that gap and that thought of teachers kind of fearing that we have to call school resource officers because it could escalate to a point of it gets out of control or a true safety threat.
Yeah, even, you know, these calls to deal with these very minor issues often lead to these, you know, viral videos that we see of officers assaulting students. Back in 2016, there was this big case in Columbia, South Carolina, where a Black student, a girl, refused to surrender her cell phone. a teacher who thought that, you know, this was a big issue in class, called in a school resource officer. The student still refused, and he ended up, you know, slamming her on a desk. And, you know, the video, you know, everything went viral, and it really forced a reexamination in that state of you know, of at least, you know, how students are charged for their interactions with police and with teachers. But as Peggy mentioned, you can have other people come in to address these sorts of issues. They don't have to be a law enforcement officer who is not trained to work with young people. And as she mentioned, in Wake County and in Denver and some other places, they're trying a different way to address these issues. We can't pretend that there aren't problems in classrooms, and there aren't overcrowded classrooms, and there aren't students who are struggling and who are going to act out because they are struggling in class. But some people are stepping back and saying there has to be another way to address this, calling the police on a kid who may be struggling with reading or who may be struggling with algebra. You know, that we don't want to do that. There's another way.
That's the voice of Corey Mitchell. He is the lead reporter on a new series of articles about this topic by the Center for Public Integrity. Also with us is Peggy Nicholson. She is supervising attorney at Duke's Children's Law Clinic. Corey, one thing I'm wondering is, as you're reporting this story, so many things in policy boil down to money and funding. And I'm wondering, with school security and resource officers, how much of a factor is that? Is there money that will be lost by police departments or school systems or another stakeholder that make this compelling to keep officers in schools and put more officers in schools?
Yes, I would say over the past like quarter century or so, there has been a tremendous amount of money made available to local law enforcement agencies and schools to hire resource officers or people to patrol campuses. And when you do have these school shootings and you do see these images, I mean, it is tough to turn down that money and say, no, we don't want any officers on campus, because there is always that threat of a school shooting, no matter where you live and no matter how old your children are. But there is a bill that has been introduced in Congress, the Counseling Not Criminalization in Schools Act, that would look to divert some of that money from school policing and pour it into, you know, school counselors, school psychologists, school social workers, and other people who can work alongside children to help address some of these issues that may be causing these problems. I mean, is it going to stop violence on campuses? I mean, probably not. There will be instances, and in some cases it's inevitable, even when you have law enforcement on campus, but there is a push led by some Democratic lawmakers to say, we can take some of this federal funding and use it in a way that's actually going to help students.
Peggy, I'm wondering, you know, we've had so much conversation and debate in terms of policies with policing in general, obviously with all of the racial disparities in our country in general. Is that paving the way for a noisier or more forceful conversation when it comes to the criminalization of school children?
Absolutely. Think yes. And the one of the most exciting things I've seen recently about the school police conversation is that students themselves are getting involved and leading it and sharing their experiences, talking about what they see as the potential benefits or harms of school police being in their schools. And it's kind of, you know, mind-blowing that they haven't been really a huge voice in this conversation up till now. So I think that, again, any conversation we have about school policing and school discipline has to involve students, and all students, especially those who are most likely to be impacted by the school to prison pipeline.
That is going to have to be the last word. I want to thank Peggy Nicholson. Again, she is supervising attorney at Duke's Children's Law Clinic, and Corey Mitchell, who is a reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. And we are discussing their series of stories that has been published here just in the past couple of weeks. Go to publicintegrity.org if you would like to read more about that. For Mike Collins, I'm Eric Spanberg. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.